listen, listen, listen. God is speaking to us.
Kairos, Milwaukee United Church of Christ presents Provoke One Another to Love. The sermon by the Reverend Jane Randall Bodman, presented on Sunday, November 18th, 2018.
The end is near. The end is near. Or so said old William Miller. Working forward from a 457 BCE decree that announced the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem, and applying a new scientific theory that a day mentioned in prophecy symbolized a year in the world, William Miller worked out the year of Christ's second coming. It was going to happen any time between March 21st, 1843, and March 21st, 1844. When the world stayed intact, he knew he had been insufficiently faithful, giving a range of dates like that. So he reworked his figures and came up with an exact date. By the next fall, 100,000 Millerites across New York and New England were so sure that they knew the day and the hour of Christ's second appearing that they put on their white robes, and on that morning of October 22nd, 1844, they climbed to the rooftops to wait for Jesus, certain that they were about to be swept up into paradise. That became known as the Great Disappointment. A lot of theological reconfiguring went into explaining what happened in the heavenly spheres on that appointed day to ease the disappointment of what had not happened here on earth. It's easy to mock, but William Miller was far from the first or the last religious leader to preach that they had figured out the key to prophecy or been given a special spiritual gift that enabled them to read the signs pointing to the end of days. Throughout human history, when death-dealing forces seem to have the upper hand, one response has been a spiritual and literary one: to look to and envision an imminent future in which God comes directly to the rescue in spectacular fashion, righting wrongs and routing wrongdoers and inaugurating a new era of justice. We call that apocalypse or apocalyptic literature, which comes from the Greek word apokalypsis, which means uncovering or revealing. God will pull aside the veil, revealing to God's people the hidden dramatic rescue about to come, and the cosmic meaning of our earthly struggles and sorrow. Because the violence, chaos, and loss in this world echo a great battle that is going on in that other world. The things that we struggle with and endure have meaning. They're part of something much larger than we are. And the outcome of this great struggle does not depend just on human agency, but on the divine will. This idea that what happens here on earth represents and correlates with a larger heavenly struggle between good and evil did not begin with William Miller, of course, or Christianity, or even the Hebrew Bible. It dates all the way back to the Persian prophet Zoroaster in around 1500 BCE. From there, it can be found in the Older Testament books of Ezekiel and Daniel and Isaiah. It's woven into early Christianity and the Essene sect of about the same time. The rise and spread of Islam fed apocalypticism in two ways. On the one hand, the very success of Islam and its quick rise was a sign to Christians that this must be the end of days. And then, within Islam itself, a streak of apocalypticism developed. And we see it right down through all of Christian history. We find speculation anxiety, and even hopeful expectation of the end of the world. There are people preaching that hopeful expectation right now in congregations all across America. Not here, but all across America. From Crusaders to Hildegard of Bingen to Martin Luther and the Protestant Reformation, down to William Miller and his flock waiting on the rooftops. Of course, William Miller's peculiarly American event, which was so certain that a new scientific way of studying the text could reveal the exact date. Well, that was hardly the last. Nor was speculation about the end of human days on earth confined to our Western traditions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Remember back in 2012, when the whole world was in an uproar about the end of the Mayan calendar on December 21st? I don't know why we thought we could figure out from a 5,000-year-old calendar that December 21st was the day, but many people waited with great anticipation. Jesus' words from the Gospel of Mark, which I read a moment ago, fit right into the tradition of Jewish apocalypticism. Those verses, along with the rest of the chapter, as I said earlier, are sometimes called the Little Apocalypse of Mark. And they share that worldview that goes all the way back to Zoroaster, that events on earth represent and correlate with a large heavenly struggle between good and evil. Earthly events are given cosmic significance. Mark's first hearers and readers would certainly have been able to look around their world and see evidence of the things Jesus was talking about and Mark was writing about. In the year 50, there was a great famine in Palestine. In 61 and 62 were the earthquakes and volcanic eruptions that took out Pompeii. In 67, the Parthian kingdom was attacking Rome. And of course, in 70, Jerusalem was invaded and the temple destroyed. This apocalyptic literature, which we find all through history, even including the teaching of Jesus recorded here in Mark, is meant to make sense of events that are happening in that moment. They're meant to cast those experiences in a larger cosmic framework, and in this way, to give comfort to the people who are currently suffering or being oppressed. These events and human suffering in general are given context and meaning. Your suffering is not meaningless in these books. And Jesus says about these things that are going to be happening, don't be alarmed. This is the way of the world. Your job, Jesus says, is not to speculate about the end of this human life or to chase after every teacher who comes along pretending that they can read the signs. Your job is to keep your eyes open for Christ's arrival, to be alert and awake and to wait. It's a sort of a keep calm and carry on kind of message. Well, I don't know about you, but in the face of wars and rumors of wars, I find the advice, do not be alarmed, a little difficult. I am alarmed a lot of the time. Living as we do in yet another historical moment of upheaval, it is sometimes tempting to read the signs of the times and to wonder, to read about wars and bombings, the famine in Yemen, the earthquakes caused by fracking, the rising sea levels caused by climate change, and the forest fires intensified by it, and to wonder if perhaps we human beings are creating so much destruction that we will come to the end of ourselves, and the earth will be rid of us. Whether we see this as being part of some cosmic battle, or see the idea of a cosmic battle as a way to mythologize and understand the suffering involved in being a human being, the story is still one that causes alarm. In the face of all the cavalcade of suffering we humans endure and inflict on each other, how do we stay both unalarmed and alert? We can begin by remembering that the coming of Christ, this cataclysmic event, this mythology, can also be understood as a constant coming of Christ, that Christ comes over and over again in each of us, to each of us. And we can live into that. The author of Hebrews lived also in an in-between time. She was trying to understand the life of Jewish Christians through the lens of Greek philosophy, in which Platonic or ideal forms are echoed and replicated on earth. For her, Jesus stands as both the ideal high priest and the sacrifice, acting not in a sanctuary made with earthly hands here on earth, but the heavenly sanctuary on another realm. And because of Christ, the author of Hebrews exhorts her hearers to come together with genuine hearts, with full assurance of faith, with a strong hold on hope, and with the willingness and intention to provoke, no, to irritate each other into love and good deeds. I love the Greek there, because you can translate it as provoke, but in more ancient literature, it's translated into irritate. Our work of love is work taken up in community, where we gather together to encourage one another and to provoke one another. But how do you provoke love? How do you irritate someone into good works? We often talk about love as something without irritation or exasperation, which doesn't make sense because most of us either live now or have lived in families where we love and are loved and where we irritate and are irritated. But we speak about love as something without irritation or exasperation. We think of it as an embrace of the other that involves only gentleness and patience and comfort. I don't know about you, but that's not my real human life. And the preacher of Hebrews notes that, and she writes about that paroxysmos of love, that irritation of love. We are drawn together into community, into church, not primarily because we already love each other, but to learn love. We gather as we do with full and trusting hearts in confidence and hope, but we also gather as real human beings with real quirks and needs, with real strengths and real fragility. And occasionally, we provoke and even irritate each other. But living in Christ's community, in trust and in hope as we do, we are not provoked into irritation or rudeness or overreaction. We are provoked and irritated into loving kindness and compassion and acts of goodness. I've seen it happen. And in this way, we learn to love not only the ones we already like, not only the people we already are like, who are similar to us in age or learning or political outlook. We also learn to love the ones we might never have met outside of church. And then we learn how to carry that love without bounds outside our own community. This community is built on trust. Here it's easy to learn to love, but we can carry that love out into a hurtful and hurting world where trust is hard to find. It's easy to grow in love here. It's much harder in a mean world. And that's why we gather together. We gather together, we keep continuing to meet together to keep learning love. We encourage one another. We build one another up. We renew and restore each other all the more when the death-dealing forces in the world seem to have the upper hand. Faced with dishonest politicians, with violence and xenophobia and racism and antisemitism and a world of difficult news, we can stay anchored in the love we find here. We remind each other of the good we are called to do. Mariana returns to us and reminds us about the Christmas gifts. The Green Team provokes us into signing letters about climate change. Linda reminds us to serve at Hoyt Street. And Jeannie reminds us to give to 2 cents a meal. Our music team provokes us into acts of praise and joy. All around us, we provoke each other into good. We come week after week, year after year, to connect and center ourselves in hope and love. And to do that, we each individually must also be centered and connected so that we can live the challenge of Mark to both stay alert and to wait. So that waiting does not leave us merely empty and longing. So we can be filled up to give to each other. A colleague, Reverend Terry Pulaski, wrote about seeing a beautiful green and black striped caterpillar on her back deck as it clung to the stem of a potted plant. It stayed there for days and days, and then suddenly it was gone. And she wondered if it had gone to create its cocoon and transform itself, or whether it was waiting, as caterpillars can do, for up to a year, putting off the moment of transformation. But eventually, it must transform into its next iteration, or it cannot live. And in order to transform into its beautiful butterfly self, it must first form a spiny protuberance at the end of its abdomen called the cremaster. It's like a button or a Velcro patch holding the pupa, the dissolved caterpillar, inside the cocoon. It's an anchor point from which the caterpillar hangs during the whole time it is transforming. I love this as an image for the still place inside each of us where no matter what, we are connected to God. No matter how the world spins or our lives change or we change, there is at our core a place of contact where we wait and where we are met. It isn't always that easy, the waiting and the seeing that you are being met. Waiting can be hard, and like the dissolved caterpillar in its pupa state, waiting can feel chaotic. Sometimes we wait, or we try to wait, and we wonder if there even is a God, or how God will show up, if God will show up. In her book, When the Heart Waits, Sue Monk Kidd tells the story of a woman who spent her entire career working harder and harder, going faster and faster, building more and more, until finally, bitter and burned out, she quit. She took time away from her life in the city just to walk in the woods and to rest. Her prayers were feverish, intense, and sped up, just like her life. She pled with God for things to change. Right now, please. One day, she came upon a spider weaving a web between two trees. She sat and watched for a long time. It was beautiful, caught in the morning light. And suddenly, she became still and attentive, and she found not just the spider's web in all its beautiful precision, but also her own life was something that was being woven in that very moment. That when she sat and when she was still and when she was attentive, with no words, No specific ask, just stillness, awake, that too was prayer. She started taking time to notice what was going on in her life and where God was already at work. Not what God might do next to solve her problem, but looking at her life as it was, where God was already present in and for her. On this Sunday before Thanksgiving, when we think of all that we're grateful for, when we connect with family and friends, I invite us to pause again in the stillness of this holy place, upheld by the love of this community, to be attentive to the possibility that God is already stirring something new in each one of us individually and us as a congregation. I invite us to sit at Jesus' feet and open our hearts, to sit and be still, mindful that the Spirit is praying in us, to sit and be still and wait in hope.